All right, we might get started. So a few of you may have seen me 5 minutes ago at the last session. So I'm chairing this session. So I'll start by introducing Michael. I've got his biography in front of me, but I've known Michael for a while, so I'll have a crack at trying to do this off the top of my head. Michael is now at Pendle. Is that correct? It does say BTIM here, but it's rebranded to Pendle now. So some of you may have seen the press there. So I've known Michael for a little while now. When I first met him, he was at Perpetual. From there, he was running multi-asset strategy at Perpetual, which is a sort of a multi-asset, a CPI plus 5 absolute return type strategy. Very successful there. Moved from Perpetual to First State Super, where he was head of asset allocation and also looked after their multi-asset investments as well. From there, he's now moved to BTIM, which has now been rebranded as Pendle Pendle Group. So Michael's an actuary, a very good one, and an incredibly good investor as well. 20 years plus experience in investment management. It's a lot better at this than me, to be completely honest. So what I might do is hand over to Michael. He's going to tell you a little bit about how he does his style of investing. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. What a fantastic introduction. That was great. Thank you. So my talk today is on, I've sort of done a bit of a play on words of portfolio construction, reconstructing portfolios with a focus on target returns. And I guess it makes sense to think about, first of all, well, why? What does target return in this context mean? And I guess the first thing is that it means a focus on investor outcomes, not peers or convention. I think we've seen over the years, it started off with kind of, retail balanced funds 20 years ago, all sort of wanting to look like each other and tracing peers as their primary objective. And then that kind of, then once super funds were opened up to investment choice, you started to see them look at peers as well. And sort of as an industry, it's just a kind of a natural thing that we all sort of, we might start off with a particular objective, but we sort of, as an industry, we tend towards that peer awareness rather, which inevitably takes us away from the actual end investor's objectives. The other element of target return means adopting an absolute return mindset. So thinking about things differently to how you would if you had a long-term strategic asset allocation and you were just taking tilts around that or appointing active managers to to manage sectors or sleeves of that. So it does require a different mindset, albeit I guess in framing what I'm talking about, because it's very similar to the stuff that I run at work, is that it's not so much about, if you like, your sort of classic absolute return, where you promise a positive return regardless of market conditions. I think many people have promised that over the years and essentially not delivered that. I think what we're saying is, well, use an absolute return mindset, but accept that if you set the lower limit of each asset class at zero and the upper limit's positive somewhere, that just on average, through a cycle, you will have some, you will be, if you like, long beta or long market exposure. I guess the other element is that it means being very active in asset allocation. And, depending on your perspective, some people see being active in asset allocation as being risky, if you like. A departure from the strategic asset allocation as somehow being risky. Of course, the strategic asset allocation in itself embeds a lot of risk. It actually comes with quite a high volatility and tends to deliver over some periods and not others. So just sticking statically to a long-term strategic asset allocation is not necessarily a low-risk decision either. But I guess if you think about the mindset required, it says, well, going to zero in something becomes a low-risk decision. If you're running a traditional fund versus a strategic allocation and you have a strategic allocation to, say, 20% to global shares and you take that back to zero, that's a very risky decision in the sense that if shares keep going up, you might get fired. So it does require, if you like, a different perspective on risk and a quite a different mindset. Now this is a category which is something very close to my heart. I've run portfolios this way in a few different places now. I've been spruiking it for a long time, relentlessly. But it is something that's close to my heart because it links back to investor outcomes and investor objectives rather than the way a lot of the investment industry is structured, which is around the agents and actually an industry structure which suits the agents rather than the end users. there are quite a number of funds in this category now, and one of the good things that I think we've seen over the last decade or so is different funds come to market who manage assets quite differently. The worst thing possible in a group like this of sort of absolute or target return funds is that they all start to look like each other, because then you're back to the sort of, if you like, the balanced fund problem again. So I think it's been quite good to see some of them look more like dialed down global macro funds, some are more of a traditional DAA strategy. Others adopt sort of quant, others a qual, and so it's quite a good mix, if you like, of product now available. So in terms of, well, why CPI Plus? Now I should have said at the start, I'm happy to take questions throughout. Feel free to stick up your hand or call out or whatever. I think it's always better if it's interactive, particularly since I've put part of here on insurance. I wanted to make sure that my presentation was not superannuation centric, as it so often is with investment presentations. But of course, that's not my practice area, so I've had to make a few assumptions. So feel free to correct me if anyone is from insurance and wants to do so. I think the first part, and where a lot of the concept of CPI Plus came from, was thinking about people in super, and particularly in that transitional phase. You know, if you look at a cradle to grave investment earnings for an individual, they'll earn about 70% of their lifetime investment earnings between ages 55 and 75. Just mathematically, that's when you have the highest balance. And so as a result of that, you actually need to earn quite a high rate of return through that period, particularly if you're going to have relatively low contributions and you want to have a really nice standard of living. But that's the point where people's tolerance for downside risk is also falling, because the last thing you want is a GFC year before you're planning to retire and then have to work for another 2 or 3 years. So you've kind of got these risks that pull at each other. You know, there's the risk of underfunding versus, if you like, what's commonly referred to as the sequencing risk of when these returns happen. And that does call for a slightly different approach to, if you like, a set-and-forget SAA, which might be fine for a 20-year horizon, but might not work for somebody who's kind of now focusing in on this thing because it's actually going to make a difference to their life. In an insurance context, obviously it's somewhat different. Though if we think about the post-retirement problem in super, we can actually think about that in a similar way to how you might think about an insurance book, in that, you know, you've kind of got a liability-driven part of your portfolio, and then you've got a part of your portfolio where you can take a little bit more risk. Now, of course, if you are holding reserves, then there's often a need for a reasonably high return to keep up with a corporate weighted average cost of capital. Don't want sort of the investments to drag on things. I'd argue there is a need for liquidity. You sometimes do hear in the insurance sector people talking about investment strategies and talking about going into illiquids. I do personally find that a little bit peculiar, just because if you sort of understand why super funds do it, their core business is actually investing other people's money. If you're in insurance and you're doing investments, then, well, you might want those reserves to be liquid so that when things go badly or times are tough, you can actually take over one of your competitors with the cash that's there rather than having the money locked up. So it does give you optionality in your business. So I think the context is different to super, so it doesn't necessarily make sense to apply the same sort of illiquidity premium logic over in insurance. You can also argue, now this is getting into a bit of a technical area, but that because in these multi-asset real return type strategies, you often have a lot of relative value positions. You might have things like long bond future of a particular tenor, shorter bond future of another tenor, or, you know, long one equity index, short another equity index. Because of the offsets, that can actually create something that's a little bit lighter on capital charges than, say, just a long equities investment. Now, obviously, it's still not going to be as good as, from a capital charges perspective, of being in bonds, but, of course, you're shooting for a much higher return than being in bonds. So perhaps there's an argument for it in terms of kind of meeting these needs of wanting to earn a reasonably high return, maintain liquidity, but have something a little bit lighter on capital charges, as long as you can get a look through of the underlying investments. Then the final thing is, well, other pools of capital. You know, things like whether they're, it could be just sort of high net worth individuals outside of super, could be things like charities. But frequently the objectives are actually fairly similar, in that usually there's a need to grow a pool of capital in real terms, a desire to manage downside risk in some form or another. If you're a charity, it might not be linked to any sort of investment consideration. It might just be that you don't want the sticker shock of one of the newspapers publishing that you lost X amount on your investments last year, because that might affect donors. The other advantage is, of course, simple governance. If you have, rather than appointing 20 fund managers to manage a whole series of sectors for you, that's actually quite complex, and it requires a large team and a lot of resources. So the idea of target return strategies is that they can be lighter on governance. Sort of turning to that traditional portfolio, and if you like strategic asset allocation focused portfolio, what I've done is looked at the contribution to risk and looked at it in a couple of ways. So I've got three bars here. So the first one, because I wasn't very good in formatting Excel charts, I couldn't get another axis over there, so I just divided the allocation by 10 to put it on the same axis. And that's the first bar. So it's a fairly typical, sort of 70-30 mix. Bit of Aussie equities, bit of global equities, bit of property, bit of alternatives, some bonds and cash. I've then done what I call a standalone risk contribution. So just looking in isolation at the volatility of each asset that you're buying, and then combining those together. So things with large capital allocations and large volatilities obviously get a fairly big chunk of that pie. But that's just simply not taking into account any correlation benefits. That's just, if you like, the sum of the weighted volatilities of each. And so that's giving you a risk of about 10.3% there. Now, of course, the assets aren't all perfectly correlated to each other. The correlations are less than one. So when we do a risk contribution, we kind of do get a bit of a benefit of diversification here. It brings it down to about a 7.5% volatility. It's something. It's not as great as what you'd like, but of course, the equities tend to be highly correlated to everything else in the portfolio, and they tend to be risky. So as a result, whilst you get some diversification benefit, it's not enormous. And also, at the end result is that you still find that equities are still dominating your total risk. Now, you might be happy with that if you have a really long time horizon, but for a lot of us, that time horizon's much shorter. Now, what I've then done is pulled out a pro forma target return portfolio. It's still got there's a lot of stuff there, so it's quite a busy chart. But basically, it's got a bunch of individual equity markets. It's got a bunch of sort of bonds, alternatives, but then also some, sort of, if you like, different processes, some trend following, some exposure to some, if you like, trend following strategies, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. It's got some exposures to some alphas where we just, look at a very active fund, a benchmark, if you like, a fairly high tracking error active fund, and then hedge out the market beta just to extract the manager's skill. So quite a different portfolio to the first one. Now, look, you can argue, depending on your beliefs on active management, you can argue whether this portfolio is better or the other portfolio is better. However, there's a couple of, regardless of which one's better, there's a couple of features that at least stand out from the perspective of the maths. One is, I designed this so that it would have 10.3 volatility as well when you just do the sum of the volatilities. Once you reduce your equities quite substantially, you actually, if you think about the difference between these two bars as being the benefit of diversification, by not being so loaded up on one single factor risk, being that equity market risk, rather than that bar falling 7.5, it's falling to more like 4.5. So you're actually getting far more diversification benefit from the fact that the exposures in this portfolio are all very, very different to each other. The other thing is you're getting something which looks a little... There's still some bars that are bigger than others, so there's still things that you could tweak, but in terms of this pro forma, you're kind of saying, well, you're getting something that looks a bit more like a licorice allsort, where you've got those multiple layers of different colours from each exposure. So you're getting a more even spread of risk, so you're not as reliant on equities to do a particular return in a particular year to deliver your outcome to your investor. Now, of course, one of the things that often comes up, and you hear Buffett talking about how you should just be in equities for the long term, and of course, he is right, very much so. If you're a billionaire, and if you've got a very long time horizon, you're happy to buy and hold assets forever, and you've got plenty of money to live off, then actually it makes a lot of sense to just have it all in equities, because equities do win in the long term. You can also load up on illiquidity if you wish. If you've got similar sorts of objectives, as long as you've got competitive advantages in illiquidity. I mean, you don't just get an excess return by buying things that are illiquid. You get an excess return by taking advantage of the characteristics of that. You know, that you have more control, that you can try and manage the asset without some of the agency issues that you get in the listed market, so that you can try and maximise it with a long-term horizon rather than a annual reporting cycle horizon. So you should, in theory, be able to get an illiquidity premium, but it doesn't just flow from buying things that are illiquid. It needs to flow from how you manage it and what you do with it, and also your skill in buying well. Illiquidity, to some extent, is very much a skill-based premium as well. So that's kind of on the long-term investor. Now, of course, because I'm doing a presentation on total return investing, I've, of course, tilted it this way to favour what I'm talking about. So there's a few things which give you a shorter horizon. Well, one is that you've got cash flows out. Now, it doesn't matter what sort of investor you are. If you're a post-retirement person, if you're paying claims, if you're managing some sort of book that's in runoff, you might be in a position where you have cash outflows. And so that brings in sequencing risk and makes actually being exposed to equities much more risky if you know you're going to be forced to sell at particular times. You also have the option, if you're liquid, that also brings with it, as I said, optionality. Now, one can be in a sort of more of a business context where being the one who's liquid and not in a damaged position can be great strategically to take out your competitors in a crisis. Also for individuals, I mean, there are advantages in having your assets in a liquid form that can be readily accessed because, you know, life changes, things happen. The other element about shorter horizon is that you get, if you like, what are called pro-cyclical behaviour by various stakeholders. Now, they could be your clients. So if you're in a super fund, it could be the members. You know, when do they switch to cash? In the GFC. If you look at the history, that's when it mostly happens. So people respond to negative returns by selling. So you might put them in a long-term strategy, but of course, by the nature of our system, they have the ability to pull the pin on that. So that negative optionality, if you like, that the individual's behaviour introduces can screw up the long-term investment strategy and actually give you an investment-y reason to pursue a shorter-term horizon. The other element is, of course, the types of things that regulators might do. You know, a GFC hits and they tell you that you need to suddenly hold more capital against your equities. As a result of that, you're forced to either raise capital in depressed markets or you need to sell equities. So because effectively that you've got, if you like, you can have that regulatory pressure in a crisis as well, because inevitably regulation tends to respond to what's happened rather than act in advance of it. Actually managing downside risk and liquidity in your book can be very important if you like almost not to have a negative optionality from pro-cyclical behaviour from your stakeholders. I've given an example strategy here. Now, what I've done is I've banged together a portfolio I ran at Perpetual with one I ran at First State Super. There's a live one now at Pendle as well, but it's only got about a month so far, and it wasn't a down month for Aussie equities. Sort of good or bad, I didn't get another point for my chart, but it's probably good for everyone's super. And what I've done here is I've basically got two lines. I've got the ASX 200, and then I've got a target return strategy. Now, of course, part of the benefit that you get is just from, if you like, dumb diversification, so you don't draw down as much of it as equities if you allocate to other things. But if you do look at, if you like, the down market beta, if you like, the average down month is minus 2.9, this strategy has fallen in those months on average by about 0.2. So you're sort of capturing a down market beta of, sort of less than 0.1, whereas the traditional 70-30 mix would have a beta to equities of about 0.5, 0.6. So you're getting, if you like, that protection, but it's not absolute return. You know, you can see there are definitely months when equities fall, where if you have some exposure because you think they're reasonably valued over, say, a three-year horizon, you're gonna have a slight drop. But because the path down is not as steep, then the path to recovery is not as difficult either. So it helps you to achieve your long-term objective without the volatility. Now, of course, with these things, we can always be accused of, particularly fund managers such as myself, can always be accused of being too positive on our ideas. So the question is always, well, what's the catch? And so, well, the catch is basically that you need to rely more on manager skill. You take equities out. We know that over 100 years, equities do deliver you a risk premium. It's it is one of those great things in investing if you've got a long-term time horizon. So it's kind of, if you like, in a way, you need to kind of swap one risk for another. I mean, you see super funds do it. They swap equity risk for illiquidity risk. This is kind of just talking about swapping some equity risk for some manager skill or alpha risk. Now, is that a sensible thing to do? Well, there've been many studies done on active management, and they generally don't cast the industry in a very good light, it would be fair to say. Now, in Australia, the experience has been a bit different with Aussie equities, but even that has sort of, the average alpha, which used to be positive, has slowly trended down over time, although it's still positive. In the US, it's definitely not. So what I've said is, well, does asset allocation alpha or skill exist? Now, it's fine for me to put up a chart of one fund, but that one fund doesn't really prove a great deal about whether this is a good category to go into. So because it's a newer category and with these funds, they've often got components which are driven by stock selection, they've got a bit of market beta, they've got the active asset allocation. Just looking purely at the returns without having a lot of information about your competitors and what they're doing under the hood doesn't enable you to isolate the alpha either. So what I did was I went to a couple of hedge fund categories. So not all hedge fund categories, because there's a lot of if ever there was a space where there's equity market beta that's sold as alpha or skill, it's hedge funds. But there are two categories which are relatively uncorrelated. So both of these, the correlation to the S&P 500 is actually very close to zero long term. And they are basically macro hedge funds, which can go long and short markets, operate at much higher risk levels than a target return strategy. But a lot of the logic and trades that you would do are actually very similar. They're just the risk level and size of those is dialed down considerably. And the other is trend following strategies. So if you like, strategies across equities, commodities, fixed income and currencies, where you're using, flying in the face of any theory of market efficiency, you're using things like simple moving averages of those indices to position yourself in a, if say a 20-day moving average is higher than a 200-day moving average being long equities, and if it's below, and if the 20-day moving average is below the 200 being short equities. That's sort of quite simple trade. There's a couple of things about this line. Well, one of them is it has trended down a bit. Now, of course, alpha is a cyclical business, and we've been through one of the worst years ever for trend following strategies. So to some extent, my end point there might be a little harsh. We've also, and part of the reason for that is just that we've had things like Brexit, where we've had a market sort of rapidly move down and then move back up. We had the same thing with Trump. That's the worst environment possible for a trend follower, because the risk off, if you like, happens just long enough to break their trend. They get set to go short the other way, and then it V's right back again. An environment like 2008 is much better for trend, because it goes down, and then whilst there's volatility, the pattern keeps going down. So if we look at these two, we can see there is a little bit of alpha left. Now, whether there's a cyclical trend up or down is sort of open for debate, but nonetheless there is some alpha there. But of course, one of the biggest problems with the hedge funds industry is the fees that they charge. So what I've gone and done is actually then blended the two. So I've said, well, if we combine a bit of macro with a bit of trend, they're both top-down asset allocation strategies, they've both got a correlation of about that's close enough to zero to equities. So let's put them both together. And so then I've got this line here which says, well, it is actually comfortably above the zero point most of the time, so there does appear to be some alpha there. But if I add back typical hedge fund fees to it to see, well, okay, the hedge fund guys bought it, and ladies, but they are mostly guys because of problems in our industry. They've gone and bought a yacht with some of this, so let's try and add that back, because a target return strategy should be priced at a much better price point than something like this, and they generally are. And so what I've done is I've assumed fees of 1.5% base and 15% performance, and I've added it back. Now, the thing that I couldn't do, because I've done this to an index, is these indexes contain a lot of hedge funds. They're indexes of open hedge funds. So what I can't capture is the fact that you're paying performance fees to the ones who are outperforming and not paying performance fees to the ones who are underperforming. So there's a bit of optionality in there. So the actual if I could capture that properly, then this line would be actually even higher. So I'm slightly understating the fees. But the point being, look, there's still a good solid sort of 2.5% of alpha gross coming through from asset allocation, from these strategies. Look, I think part of the reason for that, you're going to have some degree of survivorship bias, but the good thing about these particular, this is the SOC Gen indices, they are reconstituted each year and with open funds. So they're actually good live indices, and so the survivorship bias issue, whilst it's there, always there, will be perhaps less than in some places. There is, of course, the possibility that because security selection is basically done to death, but active asset allocation is not done by so many people and not done in such a professional way, that actually there is some, if you like, some active asset allocation alpha left on the table for investors. So that gives me great hope for target return strategies. If I sort of compare and contrast what you might do in one of these to a more traditional model and where it might be easy or difficult, I think the first part of it is to think about, well, a big part of this is active asset allocation. So in a traditional model, you might have a long-term strategic, and then you might have some, if you like, some dynamic, or whether you call them dynamic, tactical, active, sort of choose your time horizon and choose your nomenclature, but you choose different words for managing the asset allocation actively. One of the biggest problems with it is that to be successful, you need to do things which are extremely uncomfortable. So on the dynamic side, to be successful, you need to buy in the GFC. Now, during the GFC, people will be telling you not to rebalance. People will be telling you that this time it's different, and you've got to be willing to move against the herd. The more people you involve in that decision, the harder it is, because the more people you involve in a decision, the closer you get to a consensus of the finance industry. So you need a good and timely governance structure to support it. You can't have it going according to a calendar of investment committee meetings. It's just not going to work. So there's kind of a couple of things. One is you need to do things that are very uncomfortable, and so when the front page of the AFR is full of why you should not be buying equities, or even in the early 80s when you're picking up, I think it was Business Week or Time, one of those magazines, and it's talked about the death of equities, that was pretty much the bottom of the market then in the 80s. You need to be the one buying, and you kind of need to blot out the people, because bears always sound smarter than bulls, but bulls make more money, basically. And so or the bears will always give you all these incredibly articulate and smart reasons why you shouldn't be buying, when actually the bullish case is just it's cheap, and that might actually be enough in some cases. The other element is if you want to employ trend strategies, which can actually be quite good because they complement sort of that more contrarian valuation type strategy very well, but you need to be very quick to market. You basically need, if you're going to do, you can do dynamic quantitatively or qualitatively, but if you're going to do some sort of trend, it pretty much needs to be quant, because you need to get your trades to market quickly. And you need to manage your T-costs really, really well, because they make a big difference in higher turnover strategies. Of course, generally that's not going to get you there. That's not going to be enough, particularly if you want to dial down your equity beta to limit those drawdowns. So you're going to need to find some other sources of return. And really, you can divide those into macro sources of return. So, you know, thinking about like a curve trade, for example. You know, 10-year bonds are attractive, 3-year bonds are not attractive. In a lot of portfolios, you will find those, but they might be just not sized at a level that's going to make any difference whatsoever to the total portfolio. And then, of course, stock selection. Well, the other element of stock selection alpha is, in a traditional portfolio, you don't separate out alpha and beta in any sort of way, so you're constrained with where you allocate your money according to where capital is. And that can actually produce, much like the asset allocation charts, your charts of alpha can be completely distorted by that. You have all your risk in 4 equity managers, and then a really well-constructed fixed income portfolio that contributes absolutely nothing. So in thinking about using these strategies, generally there is a if you like, inertia in the market. So very few people. I've kind of put up here how you could do it. In theory, you could just completely ditch everything that you've got and just have keep your illiquids and your other alternatives if it makes sense, depending on what sort of investor you are, and then just give it all to target return managers. Nice and simple. If you pick the right ones, you should get a nice smooth ride, light on governance, quite easy. I only know of one institutional fund that's actually done that. So most finish up with some sort of hybrid model. There was a theory for a while that you might take a slice of your portfolio and give it to somebody to manage in a similar way to the rest of your, with similar objective to the rest of your portfolio, but do it very differently. I think it's a really nice concept. I actually quite like the concept. It's just really hard to put in a PDS. So what most people finish up doing is this. They shove a slice of target return in and maybe start off with 5%. Everyone always starts off with 5%. It's like the magic number in investing. It's the number where you feel like you've made a meaningful allocation, but it's not. If it does go badly, you're not going to get fired for it. And so you start. But you know, this it's a journey. And most super funds started off with 5% in alternatives 20 years ago, and now many of them have got a quarter or even more of their assets in alternatives. I did have a slide. I'm running a little short of time. I did have a slide where I compared it to a range of other alternatives. Basically, if there's a soapbox handy, I can start talking about PE fees. But basically, PE is one of those things which you sort of a lot of these things are in the illiquid category. And you know, PE is really just equities. It's just that you get this illusion by not revaluing it all the time. It's very easy to get a 500 basis point expense ratio and really. Perhaps not the future of where our industry is headed with all the pressure on costs. Infra and property can be much better and give you those if you like diversification properties, but really hard to do. And then you've kind of got I've talked about hedge funds, kind of promise absolute returns, give you a lot aside from those two categories, the trend and macro categories. If you look at long short equities and you do a blend like most people do, you just finish up with lots of equity beta and high fees. So it can be challenging. So the one question which you always get when you're asking about CPI plus 5 is it achievable going forward? And you always get that question. I got that question back in 2010, get that question now. The lower rates are, the harder it looks. The more expensive equities are, the harder it looks. I think the first thing is that there's usually an assumption that you're going to hold the same asset allocation for the next 10 years. Now, of course, if you do that, then on most asset consultants' assumptions, you are not going to achieve CPI plus 5. The way you get to CPI plus 5 is through when everyone's really scared at some point in the next 10 years, because you know you get very few guarantees of anything in investments, but you can be pretty sure we're going to have a volatile period sometime in the next decade. You need to be the one who's willing to put risk on and buy there. And if you do that, then you can get better than, if you like, just the simple sum product of the forward-looking asset class returns. The other element is that even if you do finish up with a similar return after a decade to a traditional portfolio, well, for many investors, they'll just be value in reducing that downside risk. You know, same return, lower downside. A lot of people would rather have that. I put up some charts about challenges. Look, I think you probably don't need too many charts to tell you bond yields are low. They have ticked up a bit. So I've got bond yields on here, because you've always got to put one of those into one of these presentations. Yep, really low. I put up investment grade, so it's kind of, you've got the effect of rising rates, but then contracting spreads. And then I've also put up, if you like, the inverse of price to earnings ratio. So put up equities as an earnings yield. And earnings yields are somewhat low. If you look at the US, not as bad as the technology boom. That was kind of the most expensive kind of history for equities. Not super exciting, though, relative to history, particularly if you extend that chart out even further. If you look at Aussie, it's not as bad, but it's still somewhat elevated, and particularly given some of the, you know, perhaps structural challenges to growth that we might have, given our sort of market that's top-heavy, dominated by oligopolies, many of which have a royal commission going on into them right now, which might hurt profitability. Not everything's bad, so not everywhere's... I think it'd be fair, if I was going to leave you with a less depressing message, not everything's expensive. I think you can find opportunities, but you might need to think in a less traditional way. You know, maybe you don't go global with your equities, maybe you just focus on markets that are cheap and avoid the really expensive parts. there are, of course, some practical impediments, and there a lot of those relate to sort of agency issues, that we've got a whole industry that's structured around asset class specialisation. And, you know, we've got teams of people whose job it is to appoint, you know, private equity managers, hedge fund managers, Aussie equity managers, global equity managers. It's very hard to move to something a little bit different. And the traditional asset planning cycle, where you start off with an SAA and then you do a whole lot of other things, tends to lead to, if you like, almost an under-diversification of strategy, because all your risk is in equities, but then just it all just gets loaded up with lots of diversification of fund managers. Now, is your in a lot of these strategies, you can finish up with 50 fund managers. Is your 50th pick likely to do as well as your first? I suspect not. But because you've got lots of agents all managing different little pieces of the pie, you just finish up with this, if you like, over-diversification. Now, the one thing that we do have, perhaps, as an advantage in the super system, at least, which enables us to do something different, is that post-retirement products are still small, and I'm not aware of too many surveys, and they don't get in the AFR. So it does. We do actually have an opportunity as an industry to think about doing something quite different for that part of the portfolio where we focus on alternatives. If we sort of say, well, we can fight the good fight with the pre-retirement part, but there's a lot of impediments there which lean everyone towards peer group risk. But in post-retirement, there's perhaps an opportunity to do a bit better, tear up that asset planning cycle, and start thinking about doing things differently. And that is the end of my formal prezo. So I'll take a...
Actually, I was thinking, I might come over this side so you can keep standing because you haven't stood up for long enough yet. So I thought I'll open up to the floor for questions. I was just my one reflection at the end there was, ironically, we have teams for everything. We've even got a team for selecting multi-asset managers at SunSuper. So
that's good.
Almost
keep there.
Peak irony, right? Open the floor. Anyone has got any questions for Michael, please jump up. If you're not quick, I'll start asking a few. All right, so I'm going to ask you your first question then. I sort of go back to a bit of the start there, reflecting on your time at First State in particular, did that give you a different perspective, I guess, from an asset owner's point of view on where total return strategies might fit in and some of the challenges of communicating with stakeholders?
Yeah, look, I think it's always different when you jump over the other side of the fence. It's very easy to sell things to people and say they should find a spot for it. It's much harder on the other side because you actually have to deal with all of these issues. And I think one of the big challenges is the first of all, there's a big governance challenge in running a very big fund, in that there's a lot of complexity and there's always a lot of transactional activity going on just because of the sheer number of teams and asset classes and whatnot. And that can, if you're not careful, it's very easy for that to distract focus from the bigger picture strategy. And I think that's actually a trap that's very easy to fall into. It's also very easy to fall into because often a lot of the deals are much cooler than asset allocation. The people coming in, they're buying big, shiny things. You can touch them. You can show interactive videos of them, whereas asset allocation, to many people, but not me, not Andrew, it certainly seems a bit dull to some people. So I think getting that focus on the asset allocation from everybody and getting everyone on the same page with it can be difficult. I think fitting it in has its challenges as well, and a lot of them, like, you can either do it yourself internally, and we did run active asset allocation ourselves there internally. It has its challenges. It can have its challenges, particularly as funds get very, very large, because you need to move large sums of money around in the market. That's actually one of the biggest challenges for large funds generally. And I think in terms of fitting, if you like, the multi-asset target return strategies in and where you put them and why you put them there, because we ran our own sort of overlay of active asset allocation, the main way they were actually used at First State Super, which I can talk about because we talked about it pretty publicly, was we used it in our alternatives allocation as, if you like, almost the balancing item. Because you know, if you're trying to buy a billion-dollar asset, let's say, or a $500 million asset, you might not know whether you're going to win that. You might not be able to control the timing of that. You need some way to stay invested in alts. So it was actually used as a lower cost, lower volatility, if you like, parking bay for excess capital. The rationale being, well, if I try to park that in equities, well, they can fall 40%, and usually that's when all my private markets people are going to want to start buying, which is kind of annoying if I've had the money sitting in something which has just fallen heavily, or I can put it in cash and have a massive cash drag. So the target returns there finished up being a bit of a parking bay. The one area I have heard them talked about being used by a much smaller fund, which didn't run its own, if you like, tactical overlay, was they actually put 25% of their assets into these types of strategies in order to overcome the governance problems with trying to get more active asset allocation into their funds. So I think there's sort of, you know, you can use them different ways for different folks.
When you were talking about shiny things, it did remind me, our infrastructure team recently came back from a trip and had photos up in one of their presentations where they're sitting there in high vis driving a train in Stockholm. I'm like, that's great, guys. I don't get to take those pictures, so yeah, I have some empathy for your position on that one. Okay, so another question I had for you, and this one I think is perhaps a little bit sort of timely, and I'll make this quick because no one wants to listen to me talk. In an environment like today, where equities have basically been the best performing asset, Sharpe ratio of 2+, how do you communicate with stakeholders when you go into a CPI plus 5 strategy that's basically hasn't been able to keep up over the last sort of 3 years? This is a challenge we have obviously internally as well. So I'm interested in how you deal with that.
Yeah, I think the first thing with any sort of expectation is to create the right expectation up front. So before you invest in it, you need to make sure all of your stakeholders understand how it's going to behave and when. And just like any investment strategy, then you've got to measure it against what the promise was versus what was delivered. And so I think you'd say for many funds in the category, they have delivered what it says on the can. Yeah. But you do, of course, get the comments that it looks pretty pedestrian compared to equities. And you're never going to be... I think one of the challenges is you're never going to be able to overcome hindsight investing. You see that in many facets. You see that in, when people decide that suddenly they want to manage their asset allocation actively. It's usually after a major risk event. It sort of got cool and trendy after the tech wreck because people looked at a chart and went, if I just sold there and bought there, I would have done really well. And then they sort of forgot about it for a while, and then it got popular after the GFC as well. And so hindsight is a wonderful thing. I think it's just about, if you like, almost in a balanced scorecard framework, reinforcing these funds, their objective is to do X, they're doing that, or if they're not, they're not because of these reasons related to the time horizon or some other factor, or we're firing them. And then look at the other metrics. You know, how does the risk compare? How does the volatility compare? But I think it's always difficult to preach diversification. Yep. when equities have been really strong and volatility's been incredibly low. But I think the message that can't continue forever, and just putting up a few long-term charts sort of hopefully helps reinforce that.
It's a classic line. Diversification's only good when you're wrong. Pass it to the audience.
Can I just clarify your portfolio construction? All of the alpha is coming from asset allocation. All the underlying asset class, you're not actively managing those. And if you're not, are you using index vehicles? Are you using derivatives?
So you can do it. You can do it multiple ways. So when I was at First State Super, I was using mostly index, and there I'd either use futures. Futures are, you know, they're so cheap to transact and so easy to move around that they kind of, for a fund like, for a strategy like this, they're a natural go-to place. But occasionally we'd find that, say, value stocks in a particular market were cheap, and then we might buy a basket of equities that not sort of stock picking in the traditional sense, but saying, well, stocks with a low PE or low price to book are particularly attractive right now relative to history, and so we'll go and buy 200 of those. So it's kind of a mixture, a somewhat more flexible implementation method. Now, where I am now, I work for an active manager, so I have access to a number of internal capabilities, and so the way that I deal with them, though, is I don't want to put, you know, let's say 10% of the fund in the Aussie equity capability, and then if I don't like Aussie equities, I've got to redeem all of that. So my starting point for thinking about them is to say, well, is there an underlying market that I can hedge If there's not, then I won't allocate to it because I don't want to get stuck in something. And so I'll allocate to a handful of internal capabilities that I think are good, and then my starting point is to think about that completely different to my market exposure and just say, well, my starting point for each of those is just to hedge out the market beta. And then if I want to pick up some of that market beta dynamically, then I pick that up in a different part of the process and just net the two off, essentially, internally.
Is the creation of alpha institutionalized or is it personal? I mean, if you're investing in this fund, the investor is investing in you, not the institution.
Mm. That's a good question. That's a challenge for the whole asset management industry, I think. How do you institutionalize alpha? I think the first thing is that it's a bit of both. You always have to buy into a particular team as being good and as you liking what they do and their experience and their track record. You try to institutionalise as much as you can. So if I looked at the components of that strategy, some elements of that are quite systematic. You know, the trend following strategies we employ are quite systematic. Other elements are a little more discretionary. But it's a matter of just, I guess, having one of the challenges to avoiding sort of that build up of key person risk is to have a well-resourced team, an experienced team where you've got a very shared philosophy, so that if anything happens to one person, you know, the others can continue on and create some degree of ability to replicate the process by having, if you like, a similar way of looking at the world and a similar understanding. But yeah, I think it's a challenge. It's certainly, I wouldn't dismiss it. It's a challenge for every active fund manager in the world, trying to maintain books of business for the long term. How you, if you like, manage that transition to the next generation or deal with that key person risk.
I might just make a point there because it's a question we cop a little bit internally as well. One of the things I would say on that is that I think Michael sort of touched on it early on. Retail investors can't be saved from themselves sometimes. So patient pools of capital, I think the other side of your transaction when you're making money and alpha in this space is retail people moving out of the market at the wrong time. Retail flows are generally the other side of the trades we make.
Actually, just following up, one of the things that worries me is the high level of exposure to illiquid infrastructure assets that the industry funds have sort of built up. And you made some comments about maybe not owning things where you've got to go through reporting cycles every 3 months or 6 months, whatever it is. But then one of the benefits of that is you do have the market looking at it and there's transparency and, okay, markets overreact and all that sort of stuff. But yeah. I still struggle with this, you know, putting money into funds where there is a high level of illiquid asset. But then maybe there's a lot more governance that I'm not seeing on the other side of the fence in terms of how those assets are managed or valued. I don't know if you've got some comments on that.
Does feel like a question for me more than you, but go ahead, Michael.
Well, look, I think with all of these things, it's not just allocate to infrastructure, get great returns, get great diversification. I think the asset selection needs to be very strong. I mean, we've seen things like Cross City Tunnel, Lane Cove Tunnel, a few toll roads up in Brisbane. You buy badly, you'll do badly. I think one of the other problems with them is a lot of them are interest rate sensitive. But then in other cases, often the interest in the financing structure of the asset, they may actually hedge out the interest rate. So it's very hard actually to look at it from the outside and draw a lot of conclusions about it other than the fact that it's done too well for too long as an asset class. And that, you know, if you look at the sellers of these assets, I think they're a bit better at extracting value than they were. I think a lot of people got a lot of airports with a lot of embedded value reasonably cheap, and that those things have delivered massive IRRs for, you know, a couple of decades. And so they do flatter the sector somewhat, I think. I think with all of these things, it comes down to your managing your cash flows. So the books I run, you know, the investors can pull the pin any minute. Most of them are advised as well, so they'll be a little bit more reactive to a research house downgrading us. So I need to maintain very high levels of liquidity because I've got to manage that liquidity tail risk. I think for the super funds, it's a matter of having some illiquids to exploit their long-term horizon, but not too much of a good thing because in a crisis you can get currency hedging losses, you can get member switching behaviour, and you've got to maintain enough liquidity. So there's probably a sweet spot that you don't want to push too far above, but it's going to vary for each fund, I think. So
I think that's absolutely correct. I think you've handled that exceptionally well without offending me, so that's very good. On that note, I think we're going to get cleared out of here. So I just want to take a quick moment to thank you very much, Michael, for coming in and talking to us. He's a busy man, and it's very kind of him to come down, so thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much. And thanks very much, everyone.